Hello and welcome to Level Zero. This, of course, is the show for people who want to learn more about video games, regardless of their skill level. I'm your host, Greg Griffith, and on today's episode, The Legend of Zelda and the Legends Behind It, Part 1. Navi? What comes to your mind when you hear the word adventure? What is the first thing that you picture? A beautiful landscape, maybe standing on top of a mountain, something a bit dangerous? Maybe a certain character like Indiana Jones or those kids from The Goonies.
I don't want to go on any more of your crazy Goonie adventures.
Adventure is exciting, and whether you experience it in real life or in a book or a movie, it's always something to enjoy, and it's exciting whether you're an adult or a child. And nobody knew this better than the person responsible for the topic of this episode, one of the legends behind The Legend of Zelda, Shigeru Miyamoto. Now, even if you're not very into video games, this is likely a name that you've heard before. Maybe not, but there's good reason that this name is pretty well known. Miyamoto is responsible for putting Nintendo on the map in the early 80s and is responsible for helping to create some of the most popular characters in all of video games, including Donkey Kong, Star Fox, Zelda, and of course, Mario. He is often called the father of modern video games, and is basically what Walt Disney is to cartoons, Miyamoto is to video games. And that's a common comparison, not one that I'm just coming up with to give you a picture. Now, we will get into Zelda, but first I want to share Miyamoto and his backstory with you, because it's important to the story of Zelda. Shigeru Miyamoto was born and raised in a small rural town in Japan, and he was a kid with a huge sense of adventure. Growing up, he would love to explore on his own, and he would go across the countryside and stumble upon lakes and caves, and in several interviews, Miyamoto has spoken about a time when he found a cave when he was a kid. He went into the cave, but it was too dark, so he went home, got a lantern, and would explore the cave for hours on end for days at a time, and this was a memory that really stuck with him. As a kid, when he wasn't exploring, he loved to draw. He went to college and got a degree in industrial design, but initially all he wanted to do was draw. So he looked for a career as a manga artist. Manga is like a Japanese cartoon or graphic novel, if you're not familiar with that term. But that really wasn't a super practical career for him. So in 1977, his dad helped him to get a job for a small company that would allow him to be creative, but still be a practical career. So he applied for a job at a little-known toy company called Nintendo. Nintendo hired Miyamoto as their first full-time artist. And in the late 1970s, Nintendo was just starting to dive into electronic entertainment. And Miyamoto helped to create the art for arcade games. Nintendo was developing small things like the light gun for arcades, but they wanted to create their own games. In 1980, they created a game called Radarscope that was very similar to Millipede. They figured it would be perfect for the North America market, which is where they were struggling, since Millipede and similar games were very popular there. So Nintendo had their hopes up, but ultimately Nintendo ended up with 2,000 unused arcade cabinets. They needed to try and make another arcade game that could be rewritten onto these arcade cabinets so they didn't end up losing a ton of money. And at the time, Miyamoto had been working at the company for about 3 years on various projects, and when this problem came up, Miyamoto was basically the only one available. So Nintendo told him to try and make a game for it. So Miyamoto, not having any previous game development experience, was tasked with creating a brand new game. And the game that he came up with was Donkey Kong. Without any previous experience, the first game that he ever came up with was an extremely popular one, a very successful one. Donkey Kong was a huge success and had a lot to do with how Miyamoto approached creating the game. He had no programming or technical background, and he liked art and he had a degree in design. Miyamoto thought it was important to give the player a purpose for what they were doing, so he came up with a story. A little carpenter named Jumpman had to jump to save a girl from a giant ape, not unlike King Kong. And of course, that little carpenter had a change of career and became a plumber and got a name change later you might be familiar with. But at that time, that was kind of odd, because the majority of people creating video games were programmers. But not Miyamoto. He kept pushing his new ideas, which ended up leading to a game that was new and unique. It was one of the first times a game had a storyline before the programming rather than after. So So with this hit game, Miyamoto went on to create more very popular arcade games at the time, like Donkey Kong Jr. and the Mario Bros. Arcade game. With success after success, it was clear that Miyamoto had a knack for making games. And this led Nintendo to put him in charge of making games for Nintendo's latest project, the Home Family Console. The Famicom, as it was known in Japan, or the Nintendo Entertainment System, NES, as it was known everywhere else. It's important to remember that in the early 80s, there was a video game crash. Personal computers got really popular, and the overabundance of bad video games on Atari led to consumers getting tired of the industry. And to fight against this, Nintendo had a strategy: quality over quantity. Nintendo would only release a few games every year, and they would make sure that every game that came out had a seal of quality. This meant that Nintendo would spend a lot more time and effort creating well-received games. So it makes sense that Nintendo would give Miyamoto a full year to create a new game for the Famicom, for the NES. In 1 year, Miyamoto helped to create one of the most influential games of all time, Super Mario Brothers. That's right, his first attempt at creating a game for the home console was Super Mario Brothers, and I don't think I need to tell you how popular and influential that game was. Of course, Miyamoto didn't make the game all by himself. He had a whole team of people, and two of the people that he worked directly alongside were instrumental in turning Mario into the success that it was. This dream team of Miyamoto and these other two individuals would work together to create one more great video game. Now, I'll tell you more about those other two individuals in a little bit, but at the same time they were creating Mario, and for a full year after the release of the Super Mario Brothers, the same team was working to create another game, a game that was entirely different in so many ways. Yes, now we can talk about The Legend of Zelda. Well, actually, just a little bit more backstory. Nintendo was planning to launch a new piece of hardware that would allow for bigger and better games, and they wanted Miyamoto and his team to create a game that made use of the new hardware. If you listen to the Level Zero episode on the history of the PlayStation, actually, here, just let me play a clip from that episode for you. Nintendo knew that CDs were the future, but they had a bad past experience. In 1986, they released an attachment for the Famicom called the Famicom Disk System. This would attach to the base of the original Nintendo device and play these special floppy disks to play special pieces of software. Hey, thanks, past Greg. So the Famicom Disk System was a step up in hardware, and it allowed for Nintendo game developers to create some new and exciting things. In addition to having some more memory to work with, they could also finally allow for something new: saving in games, just like a PC. So the Famicom Disk System allowed for writing and rewriting of data, and the original idea Miyamoto and his team had involved a game that was two-player, where one person would design a dungeon and the other person would try and battle their way through that dungeon that the previous person just made, solving puzzles along the way and dodging enemies. While this was a whole lot of fun for developers, Miyamoto wanted a game that was much more than just dungeons. He wanted a section that was above ground too. He wanted something bigger, something larger than a player could guess when they first started playing. Something that would invoke the feeling of the adventures that he had when he was a kid. That feeling, that's what he wanted this game to be. With more game memory available and the ability to save games, Miyamoto and his team were free to create just that, a large and expansive game that took more than just one sitting to complete. Miyamoto wanted the game to be open-ended, that required players to figure out what to do and where to go on their own without any kind of instruction. Where Super Mario Bros. Was linear, moving left to right with clear objectives, this game was non-linear, with an open world that left it up to the player to figure out how to complete. The problem was, this was a really difficult thing for playtesters, people who, you know, test games to make sure they're going to appeal to consumers, because this non-linear type of game really didn't exist before. There was a handful of games that were kind of like this, like Adventure on the Atari, but still, this was something very new, and playtesters kept getting lost and frustrated with the game. And based on the feedback, Nintendo executives begged Miyamoto to please make the game more approachable, easier, and more linear like Mario. But Miyamoto was headstrong. He was stubborn. He knew he was creating something unique that could work. He wanted people to get stuck and have to ask their friends for help and share secrets about what they found. Something that would feel rewarding to complete because it took effort and collaboration. So when playtesters complained and executives wanted Miyamoto to make the game easier, he went as far to create a version of the game that was even more difficult, where you didn't start with the sword at all and enemies were a lot more difficult. This forced playtesters to have to work together and compare notes, and playtesters actually had a much better time with this experience with this more difficult version of the game. The final version of the game actually landed somewhere in between those difficulties, but Miyamoto was making his point clear. Now, the section where we can discuss the fun pieces of video game trivia to impress your friends and break the ice when meeting new people.
Hey, what's up?
Nothing.
Hey, you know Pac-Man?
I know of him.
Well, Pac-Man was originally called Puck-Man. They changed it because... not because Pac-Man looks like a hockey puck. Paku Paku means flap your mouth. And that they were worried people would scratch out the P, turn it into an F, like...
Hey, what's up? Hey, you know Zelda? You know where the name Zelda comes from? Well, it turns out an employee at Nintendo went up to Shigeru Miyamoto when he was making the game and told him, hey, you should make a storybook for your game. And in that storybook, it should have a hero rescuing a princess. And there's this famous American author whose wife is named Zelda. How about giving that name to the eternal beauty, Zelda? And Miyamoto was like, I like the name Zelda. Okay.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Well, I got more. So, you know, Link, you know where the name Link came from? Well, in an early version of the game, it involved traveling to the past and the present, collecting microchips, and the protagonist was the link between the past and the present. And later, those microchips, they became pieces of the Triforce. Oh, wait, come back. Oh, she left. Anyway, between that story about the name of Zelda and the original story about time traveling and microchips and the name Link, you can kind of tell that Miyamoto's best strength is not really with story writing. He's great with big overall ideas and fun and engaging gameplay, but coming up with names and stories, it's not really his specialty. Luckily, he had his partner, co-creator, assistant director of Super Mario Brothers, and director of this game, Takashi Tezuka. Yes, one of the other individuals of this dream team I mentioned earlier. Tezuka was born in Japan and got a degree in design, and that's really all I can find out about his backstory. Takashi Tezuka is maybe one of the most underappreciated people in all of video game development. He is named as the director in some of the most critically acclaimed games of all time, and every game that he is involved with is incredibly well received, where Miyamoto gets all the credit and spotlight for creating these iconic characters in games. Tezuka gets very little credit for being a key component and even the director on these games. I've even watched a few interviews with him recently, and it seems that's just his personality. He wants to be one of the hardworking people in the background that goes unrecognized. At least I hope so. But the best analogy is that he truly is the Luigi to Miyamoto's Mario. Now, Tezuka was a big fan of two things that heavily inspired what The Legend of Zelda eventually became, Disney and The Lord of the Rings. The look and the design of the protagonist Link was directly inspired by a major Disney character. Can you guess which Disney character inspired the look of Link? He's got a green outfit. He has a sword. He has pointy ears. He has a fairy companion. He sometimes even fights with a shadow. You still can't guess? All right, I'll just tell you.
Come on, everybody. Here we go! Up to Neverland!
Yes, Peter Pan. Who better to invoke a childlike sense of adventure? Courageous, adventurous, adored by everyone? He was the perfect inspiration for the hero of The Legend of Zelda. So the hero had a great look and inspiration, but the hero needed to be a legend on a much bigger scale, and that's where Tezuka's love for Lord of the Rings came in handy. An ultimate evil that must be stopped, a hero overcoming all odds. Tezuka created the story of Link, a hero rescuing the timeless beauty Zelda from the clutches of the Prince Darkness, Ganon. The setting would take place in a high fantasy world, not unlike the Lord of the Rings with elves, magic, and evil. It was somewhat generic, but remember, video games in the mid and early 1980s did not have much of a story at all, especially arcade and home console games. So this was a big step forward to have an actual backstory in a fully realized world. So the game had unique and engaging gameplay thanks to Miyamoto and an inspired hero and a grand story with a fantasy setting thanks to Tezuka. They were just missing one thing, the music. And for the music, Tezuka and Miyamoto had a great idea. For such a grand fantasy, they would use classic French composer Maurice Ravel, specifically his song Bolero. It would be the perfect music to evoke a larger-than-life setting and a sense of adventure. Just listen to this. It's perfect, and because it's older, it should be in the public domain. And you can easily convert this into a chiptune playable through the TV. Wait, it's not in the public domain? Uh-oh. This is where the third and final piece of the Dream Team comes in, a man by the name of Koji Kondo, a man responsible for writing one of the most recognizable pieces of music in all of current pop culture. Yes, we need to discuss the background of just one more individual, but he's a very important piece. Koji Kondo grew up wanting to write and perform music, and he loved electronic music. He had a particular affinity for synthesizers, so he went to college and got a degree in art planning. And ideally, when you graduate from college, you apply to a bunch of places, but Koji Kondo loved electronic music, and he also really loved arcade games. So he just applied for one job that was right for him. So in the early 1980s, he applied for Nintendo, and he got the job and has been there ever since. He was offered a job to create music and sound for Nintendo games. He wrote the sound effects and music for a few minor arcade games and NES games, and then was put on a project to compose all of the music and sounds for the hit game Super Mario Brothers. Yeah, that tune you know so well, that came from Koji Kondo. In a time where music in video games didn't really have a lot of emphasis or importance, typically they just tack music on at the very end, but Nintendo hired a full-time employee to only create music for their games. And it's not like Kondo just whipped this music together for Mario in one day or anything like that. He worked tirelessly over the course of a full year writing and rewriting the music for Super Mario Brothers. He wanted the music to be perfect, a perfect balance of short jingles that were repeated over and over again, but repeated in new ways so you never really got tired of listening to them. In fact, Kondo is known to listen to his own music over and over and over again for hours. He knew that someone playing the game could be hearing these songs for that long, so this was the only real test. Kondo would not stop rewriting the music until he himself did not get tired of hearing it after that long. But enough about Mario. When Miyamoto realized that their Bolero song wasn't in the public domain, he and the team grabbed Koji Kondo, pulled him off of whatever he was working on, and told him that he had to create music for this new game. They probably told him something along the lines like, we want this to sound like Revel's Bolero and Lord of the Rings and also Peter Pan and, okay, just go. Also, we really need something tomorrow because the game is shipping really soon, so just go. So, in less than one day, he whipped this song together. It was influenced by Revel's Bolero, but also unique, and so catchy that this song has been heard in some form in almost every single Zelda game since. The sheer brilliance of the man who was given a task like that to turn around in less than one day and create this, it's pretty staggering. He also came up with three more songs for the game, and they were off to the races. The Legend of Zelda was officially released in 1986 on the Famicom disk system only. It was only available on that little floppy disk at first, and it sold really well. It did so well that it sold a lot of disk systems. The thing is, the Famicom disk system wasn't available anywhere except Japan, so Nintendo had to get it on a cartridge form for the NES to sell it to the US and to the rest of the world. Remember, the floppy disk games were bigger and allowed for saving. Cartridge games did not do this at the time. So Nintendo changed the design of the inside of the cartridge and beefed it up to include more memory and a battery for saving. It was the first of its kind, and it would be the standard for cartridge games after that. For Zelda, they wrapped it up in a shiny gold painted cartridge, which made it really appealing. And the NES version sold a year later in 1987, and of course, The Legend of Zelda was a huge success, selling over 6.5 million copies between the two versions. So there you have it, 35 years ago to this month, directly after completing the impossibly successful Super Mario Brothers, the Dream Team of Shigeru Miyamoto, Takashi Tezuka, and Koji Kondo struck gold a second time and created The Legend of Zelda, and video games were forever changed. Now, unfortunately, this team never made another game together again, but can you imagine if they did? Ha! Just kidding. This team absolutely went on to create so many more amazing games and ensured Mario and Link would be two of the most important characters in all of video games. After this quick break from our sponsor, we will dive into more games in the Zelda franchise and discuss more about the legends behind it. I'll even call a special guest to discuss some great games with me. Welcome back. So now we get to do the fun part of the show where we call in a very special guest. And you know what? Why don't we get this straight from the horse's mouth? Luckily, Mario gave me his Teams account. Everybody likes to use Microsoft Teams. Oh, connected. Hello? Hello, are you there? Is this Link? This is Greg from Level Zero. Mario gave me your number. Hello? Can you hear me? Says it's weird. It says it's connected. Let me try again. Hello? Link, can you hear me? Hello? Showing it's connected. Oh, maybe your microphone is muted. Hello? You there?
Hey!
Oh, Navi? Hi, this is Greg from Level Zero.
Hello!
Is Link there? I don't mean to be rude. I'm just trying to do a podcast, and Mario gave me Link's information, and I wanted to see if maybe he wanted to talk about some of the big Zelda games with me.
Watch out!
Oh, for what? Oh. Sorry, you must be busy. I didn't mean... Ooh. You okay, Link? Well, so sorry to interrupt. I'll go ahead and let you go. Thank you. Bye-bye. Well, that didn't work out. Probably have to edit all that out anyways. But I guess I'm on my own. So after a successful original, Nintendo immediately requested a sequel from Miyamoto. So Miyamoto had just 1 year to create Zelda 2, The Adventure of Link. This game was very different from the original one that came before it. For most fans of the series, Zelda 2 is not as highly thought of because it's extremely challenging, and it's just very different from the original, almost unrecognizably so. The perspective of the game changed from a top-down perspective to a side-scrolling perspective during action sequences, and it had an experience system that made you a lot stronger with the more enemies that you killed, very similar to like an RPG. And overall, it was just a very different combat system. Even the music sounded really different. A lot of folks even question why on earth it was so different when the original was so successful. Well, I have the answer. There are two parts. One, at the time, for arcade games, remember Miyamoto was making arcade games, it was standard for sequels to be very different and allowed developers to try new things and still cash in on the success of the previous titles to see what appealed to different audiences and what didn't. Donkey Kong Jr. was very different from Donkey Kong, and of course, the US version of Mario 2 was very different than Super Mario Bros. 1. With Zelda 2, it was no different. To change up the genre? Sure, why not? And two, and the much bigger reason, there was no dream team for this one. Takashi Tezuka was busy with other projects and was not really involved in this at all. He was only credited as the writer. And of course, the last piece, Koji Kondo, well, he was also busy on other projects. So even though Miyamoto was in charge, there was a different director and a different composer for this one. Still, even though it didn't have the dream team and it's not remembered quite as fondly, it did some interesting things. And ultimately, it sold incredibly well. It was a complete success for Nintendo, selling over 4 million copies of the game, and it was highly reviewed and regarded by consumers at the time. People had a lot more patience for very challenging games back in 1987. Now, there was just 1 year to make that game. For the next Zelda entry in the franchise, Nintendo wasn't going to hold back. There was a brand new console with much better processing power and sound capabilities, the Super Famicom or the Super Nintendo. And for the 16-bit system, Nintendo gathered together the Dream Team again, with Miyamoto as the producer and overseer, Takashi Tezuka as the writer and director, and Koji Kondo once again doing all of the music. And this time, they were going to give him more than just 1 day to write all the music for it. They were given much more than 1 year to work on the project as a whole, and in 1991, Zelda: A Link to the Past was released just 2 months after the release of the Super Nintendo in the US. That intro music really makes a statement. Link to the Past was a return to form in music, gameplay, and story, and all were much improved upon the original. It was all top-down perspective again, and the gameplay was smooth and engaging with varied environments and worlds to traverse. The story was much more narrative-driven, and the music, well, just listen. It really was amazing how much better the sound was on the Super Nintendo compared to the NES. If you remember from the previous episode of Level Zero, the history of the PlayStation, when Ken Kutaragi, the founder of the PlayStation, originally developed this sound chip for the Super Nintendo, and it greatly improved the sound capabilities. Here, let me give you the sample from the song I played earlier from the NES from the original Legend of Zelda. And of course, here's the Super Nintendo. So clearly, Koji Kondo had a lot more to work with, and he could create music that could create atmosphere and a sense of tension and dread, and he sure used that in this game. Link to the Past also featured a lot of various environments, and even the Dark World, which was a very dark and twisted version of the main world that you were in. This game also featured staples for the Zelda franchise, like the Master Sword, the Hookshot, and three pieces of the Triforce. Triforce, that's way better than Dream Team, I should be using that. Anyway, with the return of the Dream Team Triforce, this game sold very well. Over 4.5 million copies sold, and plenty of Zelda fans still call Link to the Past their very favorite Zelda. For me, it's number two behind one of the games we're about to talk about. Unfortunately, Link to the Past was the only Zelda game to release for the Super Nintendo, and it would be another 7 years until the next big Zelda game released on a home console. It would be a long wait. It wasn't a complete dry spell for Zelda fans, though. Fortunately for Nintendo, a handful of programmers were having fun with a side project. They were trying to create Zelda on the Game Boy. The Game Boy, of course, the little handheld 8-bit console. They wanted to see what this hardware was capable of. One of the programmers at Nintendo started this little after-hours project, and a few other folks at Nintendo joined in too. Eventually, Takashi Tezuka caught wind of the project, took a look at it, got excited, and he pitched it to Nintendo. Could we please turn this after-work side project thing into a real project and get funding? And Nintendo said, okay. Tezuka worked alongside this team and directed this game, and at first, basically all he wanted to do was to take Link to the Past and put it on the Game Boy. But unfortunately, that turned out to be a little bit too challenging to port the game onto the Game Boy. Plus, there were already some new and interesting ideas made, so it eventually turned into its own game, and the game would be called Link's Awakening. And because this was a Game Boy game, Tezuka and the team didn't really feel constrained by the lore of the world and the Zelda series that had been set up to that point. Tezuka was even quoted in an interview saying, "It doesn't really matter what we do with the story, it's just a Game Boy game." So with those restrictions gone, they weren't afraid to try a few new things, like giving Link the ability to jump and unequipping your sword and equipping it with a different item instead. They also weren't afraid to get a little bit weird. Tezuka was actually a big fan of the show Twin Peaks, and he had said more than once it was a big inspiration for Link's Awakening. And the story was really different. This time around, there was no Zelda. There was no Ganon. Instead, Link washes ashore on a mysterious island, and is the island even real? Are things really what they seem? For Link's Awakening, they didn't have the Dream Team. Both Kondo and Miyamoto were busy on other projects, and Miyamoto didn't get involved until the very, very end of the project, where he helped with some gameplay testing and gave some suggestions, but overall, Miyamoto was super surprised and impressed by the game. He doubted that the Game Boy hardware could handle a substantial game like Zelda, and he was proven wrong. And as for the music, even without Kondo, the music was great. It was unique, and it fit a unique game. Link's Awakening released in 1993 and was one of the highest-selling Game Boy games. It was met with critical and commercial acclaim and got a special remake when the Game Boy Color came out in 1998, That version of the game featured all new colors and even a brand new dungeon. Between these two versions, Link's Awakening actually outsold A Link to the Past. It even recently got a full remake for the Nintendo Switch in 2019. So between being one of the most successful Nintendo console games, and with an extremely popular unique handheld game, it was clear to Nintendo, Zelda was going to be as important as Mario, and could be a huge success on every single Nintendo device. The next Zelda game would be the biggest one yet, and would have the longest development cycle. Yet again, Nintendo was developing a new Zelda game for its newest hardware, the N64, and this time, the latest in technology, 3D technology. Yes, now we get to talk about the big one. The development of this game was very strange, and there was an incredible amount of pressure that Nintendo put on themselves, particularly Shigeru Miyamoto. This new Zelda game was in development concurrently with Super Mario 64, and not only was Miyamoto in charge of creating that game as both the producer and the director, he was also put in charge as the producer of this Zelda game, and also had to be a supervisor on this project for, get this, 5 different directors. Turns out going from a top-down 2D perspective to a fully realized 3D space was an incredible challenge. The different directors would each do a different piece of the game, and Miyamoto had to organize it all. Where previous titles had a team of 10 or 20 employees, not including external contractors, this Zelda game had 50 Nintendo employees working on it. And if you include contractors, that number was about 100 employees. It was originally planned as a launch title for the N64 to release right along Mario 64, but Miyamoto was just one guy, and making games is really hard. So Miyamoto had it pushed back to allow for more development time, not just 1 year, but 2 full more years, making it up to 4 total years they had to work on this game. It had to be perfect, but the more it got delayed, the longer the N64 had to go without its hit games. And the more pressure was on Nintendo to release an amazing Zelda game. The game was going to be called The Legend of Zelda, Ocarina of Time. Ocarina of Time. Wait, have I been saying that wrong? Hold on. How to pronounce Ocarina?
Ocarina.
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 Macarena.
Ocarina.
The Legend of Zelda, Ocarina of Time. Apparently I've been mispronouncing that for 23 years. Okay, well, what about the Dream Team? Did we have them for this? The Triforce? You bet your bottom we did. Shigeru Miyamoto in charge, Takashi Tezuka taking on a supervisory role. I dug into this a little bit and couldn't find out exactly what Tezuka did, but he certainly was working on this game, and I imagine his influence was instrumental. Speaking of instrumental, the person in charge of music, you betcha, Koji Kondo. And music would play a major part in Ocarina of Time, both in the traditional sense of creating atmosphere and feeling, but also in a much more direct way where music takes on a major part both in the gameplay and in the story. Early in the game, you were equipped with an ocarina. Different buttons would play different notes. In fact, the buttons on the N64 controller even resembled what an ocarina was, and Koji Kondo tried to make it as interactive as he could, and he tried to make it seem natural too. During the game, players were shown how to play a song, and players had to learn and repeat the song back using the different buttons on the controller. This forced Koji Kondo to create several of the game's themes with an extremely limited scale of just 5 notes, which was really difficult, but it ended up sounding really natural in the end. So a decade after creating the original, Miyamoto and Tezuka were both in charge of teams of people. So same thing here, right? Koji Kondo was the lead composer and had a team of musicians and musical programmers, right? Nope. He did 100% of all the music by himself. He did this song. And this song. And this song. And even this song. He wrote and performed every single one of these songs all by himself, and I doubt anyone can argue that this is some of the very best music in the series and easily the top 10 video game soundtracks of all time. Koji Kondo is ridiculous. Miyamoto was dead set on creating the best game possible, one that was near perfect in every single way. And when Ocarina of Time released in March of 1998, it was. Selling over 7.6 million copies, it was the most successful one so far. Clearly, it did well commercially, but how did it do critically with game publications? Well, most outlets that reviewed games gave it a perfect score. And to this day, the review aggregator website Metacritic has Ocarina of Time as their highest reviewed game of all time. It's hard to explain this game's influence on the medium of video games. It drew a clear line in the sand between what video games used to be and what they could be moving forward. It impacted how people see video games, and it would influence almost every single 3D game made after that point. Especially the action-adventure genre, there would be no Assassin's Creed if it weren't for Ocarina of Time. It is my number one game of all time, and I don't see it budging from that spot anytime soon. So over the course of 12 years, Nintendo released 5 major games in the Zelda franchise, and almost every single one of them was a major success. The original game changed what games could be on a home console and invented the action-adventure genre. Zelda 2 was a game that had the word adventure in it. Link to the Past would prove that with the right team of individuals and enough time, you could improve upon an original in every single way. Link's Awakening proved that you could have a larger-than-life adventure on a small scale. And Ocarina of Time? That would bring the world into a 3D adventure and change video games forever. The Triforce Dream Team of Shigeru Miyamoto, Takashi Tezuka, and Koji Kondo changed what video games could be on the home console. Not just a fast-paced game where you try and get the high score, but something you could be immersed by. Something that you can experience directly, where you can imagine yourself in the shoes of a hero and save the day. Video games could create a sincere experience of adventure. So that is all for part one of the Level Zero Legends of Zelda series. There are still 23 more years of history and at least 10 more mainline Zelda games to discuss. And can we do it all on the next episode? We shall see. Thank you so much for listening to Level Zero. If you have any questions or comments, or if there's something you want to know about the Zelda series that you always wondered, let me know. Send me a question. You can send me questions at questions@levelzeropodcast.com. And maybe I'll answer your question on the next show. You can also hit me up at our Facebook or Twitter page, which is @levelzeropod. All those links are down in the show notes. Thank you so much for listening. If you liked what you heard, tell a friend and make sure that you subscribe so that you never miss a new episode. Thank you so much for listening, and we're going to see you on the next episode, part two, The Legends of Zelda. Thank you.
Ocarina.
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 Macarena.
Ocarina.
All right, just one more time. What's happening?
Ocarina. Ocarina. Ocarina.
Yeah, that's amazing.